Hello and welcome to Blind Spot Radio. I'm Dave LaSpina.
And I'm Dave Bush. This is Blind Spot Radio, the radio show about photography on 90.7 WGXC, ACRA, community radio serving Greene and Columbia counties. Blind Spot Radio focuses on discussions with people in the photography field. Photographers, curators, writers, critics, artists, and innovators in technology.
The reason that we thought this radio show would be great in the Hudson Valley is because there's so much going on here, from small galleries specializing in photography and museums that have a strong curatorial program involving photography. This month on the show, we have photographer Mark Haven, who spends some time in Lexington, New York, but also lives in New York City. Mark Haven was an editorial photographer in New York through most of the 70s, photographing for Stern, Fortune, and was one of the first contract photographers for New York Magazine through much of the 70s. Later in his career, he started teaching at the newly formed BFA program at the Rochester Institute of Technology, where he specialized in teaching editorial photography, editorial lighting, as well as long-term documentary projects.
He was also your teacher.
Yeah, he was my teacher. And I was his teaching assistant for many years. All throughout undergrad. Mark is having a show that just had the opening this past Saturday at Davis Orton Gallery, which is a new photography-centric gallery right here on Warren Street. And we encourage you to check it out. I have more details about the show later in our pre-recorded interview. Dave, what else are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're going to talk a bit about the end of film. And by that, I mean the sort of transitionary stage that photography finds itself in right now, where many of the films that we have, you know, beloved for years are starting to be discontinued. And I know that this has been going on for several years at this point, but we thought it's a poignant topic of conversation. It affects all of us as photographers, or many of us who haven't switched it to digital yet. So we're going to touch on that.
Well, it might be a completely dead subject to some.
Well, it could be.
But
I think it's pretty relevant.
It's pretty relevant, and we're going to talk about some solutions for you as a photographer at home.
Yeah, what's out there?
What's out there? I know we've announced new cameras on the horizon and such, but we're going to talk about some economical solutions. And as your young family member, or if you're getting into photography for the first time in your life, some things that you might want to consider. Things have gotten very affordable.
Yeah.
And
complicated.
And complicated.
I think.
Adobe has brought some news onto how you're going to have to purchase Adobe Photoshop. I got a mailer yesterday. I'll tell you more about that.
Okay.
But we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back.
Blind Spot Radio.
Hello, welcome back. You're listening to Blind Spot Radio on WGXC 90.7. I'm Dave LaSpina.
And I'm Dave Bush.
So Dave, we're going to talk about a much belabored point that we've heard back and forth amongst photo geeks and even the casual consumer of photography. It's the first thing that someone always asks me at a cocktail party when I'm attending them.
Yeah, it's true.
It's a small talk.
Yes.
Digital camera.
Which is, do you shoot digital or film?
Or film. And it's starting to reach a point where there's going to be no other answer.
Right, that's true. Because now, even though on this show we've touched on Kodachrome, right, being discontinued, we actually devoted an entire segment to one of our last shows to Kodachrome. And David was one of the last participants in
Right. I photographed a roll at the sunset right before the FedEx man came to the cutoff date to send my last roll of Kodachrome to Kansas to be developed. And now
Kodachrome's younger brother,
Ektachrome.
Or should I say cousin?
Yeah, which is more widely used because it's more affordable. It didn't have the same color permanence, but it's widely used in projection, teaching, copy work, which is where you photograph an original piece of artwork. And the reason it was used because it had a very fine grain structure.
Right.
And when people made drum scans to reproduce stuff for books, it was the ideal positive format. It was much easier to make a digital image from slide film, and that was the standard for several decades now.
The chemistry was also much more accessible. It wasn't so proprietarily protected by Kodak.
Yeah.
So, you could send it down the street to get it processed, and you'd have it in an hour, literally. So.
You could even do it at home. I did it. They sold kits.
Right.
I developed some back in high school.
And I used to work for a guy in New York, and that's all he shot was Ektachrome. There were two kinds. There was the 200 speed for daylight and the 100 speed, or was it the opposite?
Well, they had a 64 speed for tungsten.
They also had a 64, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. You could also push process it really easily. Yeah. You can make it into 400 speed or 800 speed.
Right.
But, it was more accessible also because the other two major film companies, Agfa and Fuji, had figured out how to crack the egg and weren't infringing on any copyright.
They had their own process.
So it was a worldwide process. And Fuji is still going to continue to make its version of slide film, Fujichrome, and I think it's Astia, they call it. And it has a very fine film grain. So that will be going on for a little bit more. But I know, at least at our school, we're chucking the old Kodak Carousel slide projectors.
Really? We still have ours. But we're kind of stuck in the film era.
Right.
And the reason for that, if we could just touch on that for a second, and at least in the education world, which is where David and I both work, is that, the darkroom is a great teacher. It kind of teaches the students what to look for and what a good print, looks like, And to me, it's a great tool for that reason. It helps the students figure out, what photography looked like for the past 150 years.
And there's less room for failure. There's a narrower window for success.
Right.
You can only be about a half stop. You can only be about a half stop off in exposure, either in film or when you're making the darkroom print.
Right.
And a sign of things wrapping up or ending in terms of color printing, in which you use a color negative. Which is what most consumers used throughout the late 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, is that at school this week, our color processor kind of bit the bullet and started leaking all over the ground. Bit the dust. Color chemistry has a very nasty, basic, high pH chemical in it that we were contending with at the same time with hydrochloric acid.
No, it's not good for
you. We're trying to neutralize it before we dispose of the chemistry. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much we want to shorten our lives using this stuff.
Well, that's always been the sort of debate. But it's odd because I was thinking about this on the way over here. Here we are in New York, the sort of, epicenter of, whatever the modern world. And if you call around other places around the country, film is very much alive and well. It's like a lot of the places that I deal with when I'm on the phone, trying to fix something like our color machine or, some other processing thing, I have to call the Midwest or down South, and people are, there's still companies, people still work for these companies. And as far as they're concerned, it's not going anywhere, or at least not soon. It's an odd kind of dynamic.
Well,
because here we are on the kind of the front lines of everything changing, and we're always kind of panicking about that. there's still a huge infrastructure that surrounds this stuff. So
right.
Anyway.
And you, but most of Kodak's bankruptcy has dealt with them severing different divisions that don't make money. And one of the things right. that, you know, Kodak ended up on the chopping block. They're no longer going to make their own consumer digital cameras.
Right.
All they're going to do is make chips.
Yeah.
They do make chips for Nikon and some other companies and for Sony. But one thing that has happened is the films that they are dedicated to, which is color negative film, which is still heavily used in the movie industry. And I always thought that as long as they're shooting long rolls of 35 millimeter film and movie cameras, which is coming to an end,
which is a big expense,
right? They will keep up the production lines for those things, but other odd formats like 4x5 sheet film and 8x10 sheet film have gone way up in price.
Yeah, it's insane,
right?
I used to shoot a lot of 8x10, and it would cost $80 for 10 sheets unprocessed, and people mostly their jaws drop. And I was just looking on B&H the other day, and that price is almost doubled, which
yeah.
is completely off the charts.
Right.
Insane to me. That means that your plus processing, your cost is now $25
per photo,
per picture when right. you push the button.
don't make sure you're in focus.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right. And double check your exposure.
Yeah, your meter readings.
Right. So yeah, it's becoming increasingly
prohibitive the word.
Cost prohibitive. Yes. But Kodak's gotten rid of other formats. 5x7 sheet format has
right.
gone by the wayside unless you have $15,000 to make a large bulk order.
Right.
It's actually cheaper just to cut down 8x10 film.
Yes.
And talking about cutting, Kodak is no longer making any cut sheets of photographic paper. You either have to use big rolls,
yeah,
which has sort of caused a weird art trend where everyone's making
is that right?
Weird
I had no idea.
Rainbow rolls
of
photograms and everything.
Huh.
I think that those two have gone hand in hand.
Yeah.
You're like, I have this giant 40-inch right. roll of paper. Might as well.
Interesting. Didn't want to just switch to Fuji.
Right.
Right. Be easier.
Easier. No, but it sort of caused an art trend of large photograms. I think the two go hand in hand. But you can still get Fuji sheet film, which is actually quite affordable. It's actually cheaper than black and white. Cut sheet paper.
Yeah.
It's actually cheaper than black and white paper because it uses less silver.
Yeah.
So you can get a box of 8x10 for $40, whereas black and white photo paper is around $60. But all that said, having access to a color darkroom is more cost prohibitive. You can still have a black and white darkroom in your bathroom, and Kodak is committed to making our favorite D76 and D72 developers and Fixer
and Dektal.
Yeah. and all that, because they do find their chemical end of their business profitable.
Well, that was part of their deal, is what I was told.
Right, they were required to keep those divisions.
When they got their big loan.
Kodak Chemical has its own listing on the New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
It's a whole other animal.
Yeah.
They make other evil stuff like hydrochloric acid and
right.
Not that that's evil. That's stupid to say. I don't know what sort of fertilizers
from an environmental standpoint.
Right.
Maybe
things
not good.
Tough to make.
Yes.
Safely.
Things that are needed, but
right. So, but there's a lot of cool scanners that are coming into the price range where you can digitize your roll film or your 4x5 or even your 8x10 film. And,
right.
and Dave, we've messed around with scanning a 8x10 film on this Epson's V750 scanner that you have at home.
Yeah, it's a great scanner.
Right.
For the price especially, it's probably the best thing you can buy.
Right.
Actually.
It's actually around $600.
Yeah. The 700 is a little cheaper,
right.
I think, but it's basically the same thing.
We've even done comparisons with this this high-end scanning flatbed company, Creo, and the sharpness is the same, but the thing that we notice that you lose is a little bit of the shadows and the highlights, which is called the dynamic range.
Right.
And then to print out your work, Epson printers and Canon printers have really come down in price, and you know, it's always been the case that they give you the printer really cheaply, but then you're
the inks.
You're buying ink at $1 per milliliter.
Right.
And so
is that right? Is that right. Correct?
I think yeah. Oh, wow. It's a, you know, you get 100 No, maybe it's more like 50 cents.
Okay.
But yeah, it ends up costing 1.5 cents per square inch or something.
Wow. Amazing. No,
but it adds up quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
30 by 40 costs like $50 to make.
And you need a computer.
And you need a computer.
And you need the software.
So and you, yeah. So, you know, it all adds up.
But and then, you know, it's like you're not, you don't have a, you know, dark room
right.
in your house with chemicals and all this.
And all that sort of stuff.
So it's a trade-off.
Trade-off. So, yeah, the Epsons have really, really gotten really quick and quiet, and they calibrate themselves, and the colors are beautiful. Epson makes a 17-inch that's called the 4900, and the 24-inch is a 7890 or the 7900,
right.
and a 44-inch, and there's lots of companies that are willing to just, like, ship it to you for free, and I just bought a brand new 7890, not to endorse anything.
No.
Canon has finally caught up with their Image Prograph series that has the same 100-year permanence standards.
Which I believe Larry Fink uses.
Larry Fink uses, yeah.
This is a Canon. I don't know which one, but anyway.
And these printers are finally getting to the point where the black and white prints look quite beautiful. They, they're pretty neutral, which has always been a problem.
That was always a huge problem.
Right. And so, you need a computer, and I can say right here that, you know, having used Macs and PCs, the old rumor that you need to have a Macintosh, I think, is straight out the window.
Right. Really?
Huh. Yeah. You know, I use a Dell Tower at work.
Oh, okay.
And the tower costs about half as much.
Right. Yeah. Well, that everybody knows that.
Everyone knows that. Yeah. And the biggest upgrade that we would recommend for working on your home computer is that you upgrade to a solid state drive.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, traditionally hard drives have spinning parts, which are a lot slower in terms of data read and write, as opposed to the solid state drives, which are just oversized compact flash cards.
That's not to say that you need that.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, I know you have one, you love it, but, I don't have one and I'm fine without it.
Right. So. Well, I'm just saying if you buy a cheap PC or a lower end Macintosh,
and in fact,
you can always pump things up.
And in fact, those solid state drives having come out recently have made the more traditional drives way cheaper.
Oh yeah.
So it's actually a good time to buy a
IDE traditional 7200 slot RPM drive. Slot drive.
Yeah.
Oh, well, exciting stuff, everyone.
So, David, let's take a break.
All right.
And we'll come back and we'll continue this conversation.
Yeah, we'll talk about some affordable digital cameras and the new way that Adobe is planning to charge us to actually get their money from us for not stealing Photoshop anymore.
Right.
We'll be right back.
Church. What are we doing?
Welcome back. This is Blind Spot Radio. I'm Dave Bush.
And I'm Dave Lispina. You're listening to us live on WGXC 90.7 or streaming on WGXC.org. And we can always remind you to support WGXC by Absolutely. Going to WGXC.org/donate or look for the link on the homepage where you can find schedules for local events and exhibitions. Special events associated with the radio. There's a great open mic every week right at the Spotty Dog on Warren Street. But we were talking about the demise of film and the difficulty of printing and using film.
And some alternatives of traditional darkroom.
Right.
And what you can do with those negatives if they're already made.
And sort of hybrid, you know, scanning, film.
Scanning, printing. This is what people do.
Right. And but you can always just buy a digital camera.
Yes.
I've been purchasing digital cameras for students to use recently, and I am surprised that the low-end cameras, the Nikon D3100 and the Canon Rebel, which you can purchase anywhere at your local store for around $550 with a lens. And they're like 16 to 18 megapixels.
It's not a full-frame chip.
Right.
Meaning the chip is not 35 millimeter size. Slightly smaller.
Jinx.
So
you can buy them for like under $600. And they also shoot in RAW format. I'll get to that in a little bit. There's some really amazing new technology where the Sony A99, which has a 24 megapixel chip in it, it actually has a translucent mirror. So when you take a picture, the mirror doesn't go up to have to put the image on the sensor.
You
can constantly see through the image, which isn't even an optical viewfinder. The light doesn't travel through a prism to your eye. They actually use a small version of the OLED iPhone type screen and have that in the viewfinder.
Wow.
And it actually looks sharper and more vibrant than real life.
And more accurate probably to your, when it translates to your screen.
In real life. And like right on the screen, it shows you a histogram through the viewfinder. And for you sports photographer enthusiasts, you can take like 12 frames per second.
Wow.
And so
That's fast.
12 frames per second. And every photo that you take,
That was me.
Guess that camera. And then, so imagine this, 12 frames per second, 50 megabytes per photo. So your memory cards are going to fill up quickly.
Very quickly. You may as well just get a video camera.
Get a video camera and take stills.
Seriously.
But each of these cameras have a proprietary format. And at one point, the original designer of Adobe was on vacation, and he got frustrated, and he was like, why do I have to download Nikon software, Canon software, to open up my RAW files? And while on vacation, the story goes, he reverse-engineered the RAW files and made a new common format that Kodak and Adobe co-engineered called Adobe DNG, which stands for Digital Negative. And the reason that I think Adobe's still in business is that when you buy a new digital camera, you need to buy the latest version of Photoshop, which retail is cost prohibitive the first time around.
Right.
$850 at your local office supply store. But the upgrade version or the student discount version has always been more affordable. There still is no competition really out there for Adobe Photoshop.
Not really. And I've heard people say Lightroom is fantastic. I've never used it.
But, right. Well, that's an Adobe product, too.
Is it? Okay. Yeah.
But Aperture is a Macintosh program. A lot of people have been using it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like a sort of professional caliber platform, Lightroom and Aperture do these other things where they do this thing called digital asset management, which is a fancy word for organizing your photos.
Right.
Which is very difficult to do. It makes a searchable database of your pictures.
That's pretty great. I could use that actually.
Yeah.
But
but I think that your files the big scans that you've done from your 8x10s and the big files from your Canon that you use really slow down those sort of programs, and that you really need a really strong computer to do that.
Yeah, true.
Because index, and you've taken hundreds of thousands of pictures, so it takes a lot of time. I run into that too. I thought it'd be great. Oh man, I can use Lightroom. But Lightroom actually maxes out at a certain point once you get up to 100,000 pictures, it freaks out and you have to start a whole new collection, catalog, that is what they call them. But
for, let's say, the casual, more casual user,
yes,
it might be a little more streamlined and more approachable.
And affordable.
Than a behemoth like Photoshop.
Photoshop, right.
Because it takes a long time to learn Photoshop. It's a huge, huge program.
It's not as intuitive as these other programs.
Right. Yeah.
They have a lot of things built in, like click a button and you have a black and white photo, make it brighter and darker with the adjustment things right there all the time. In Photoshop, you kind of have to open up a window and then do it, and then you're using these things called layers. The main thing is that Photoshop has always been the
standard. Yeah.
And it really adds compatibility to when you're buying these latest, greatest affordable cameras. And kind of breaking news, last month, Nikon is coming out with the D3200, which will be like $600 or something, and it'll be 24 megapixels.
Wow. Huh.
So that's the same.
Amazing.
It's the same same chip that the Sony A99 has for half the price.
Wow.
So you can make a nice 20-24 or 30-40 print from that if you have a nice lens.
Yeah.
That's the other thing with these cheap digital cameras. They come with very cheesy zooms.
Right.
But you're going to end up spending anywhere between $200 or $2,000 to get a primo lens.
So it's not just about the chip size and the pixels, megapixels. It's also about glass. It's about the lens that you got.
And holding your camera steady. You should get a tripod. Yeah. You get a tripod. Sure. That's what I always tell young photographers.
Yeah.
These cameras have these high ISOs and let you, you know, fling them around your neck and take pictures at the same time.
Right.
Still good photographic practices are very necessary. And Adobe Photoshop just came out with their new CS6, and I got a mailer yesterday.
Right. And this is interesting. I think this is kind of an interesting thing. Why don't you tell us about
it? Right. So, you know, Photoshop has always been pilfered, and people usually use it illegally. But they've sort of made
not usually.
Most of the time. Really? I think that's why it's so expensive.
Okay. All right.
Like, who's going to...
It's been a huge problem for them.
Right. Yes. They've lost millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars over the decades.
Right.
But the way that they're sort of allowing a more affordable entry level way into this is that for a monthly fee, which is, you know, about 5% of the retail cost of Photoshop, each month you can pay to have access to all of their programs, and they're also sort of adding a cloud computing component to it where your files aren't stored on your computer at all. They're out there on the cloud, and you can access them from a variety of platforms. Say you have a computer at work, a computer at home, and they've also created iPad and iPhone and Android versions of Photoshop, so you can open up a file, resize it, email to someone, and never really have to locally store these files.
Right.
So now you can, you know, be a photographer, wirelessly upload your digital SLR files to the cloud, and then edit them on your iPad and send them into the newspaper that you work from.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing stuff.
Cool stuff. But who knows? Let's just load up a roll of tracks and go take some pictures today.
Yeah, seriously.
Right, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
I'm all for it.
All for that. So speaking of film photography, there's a great show by Mark Haven called The Commute at Davis Orton Gallery. And when I come back, I'm going to introduce Mark again, and we're going to talk about his career and two bodies of work, one led into the other, all involved his long commute, working out of Rochester and commuting back to his home in New York for several decades. And he, along his way, made some great pictures. So you listen to Blind Spot Radio on WGXC. We're going to take a quick break, and
we'll be right back.
Out of the rain into Maria's wedding day, and I sat there with her friends and with her family, and I was happy. I wasn't someone they'd invite, and I didn't know the groom or know the bride. But when I stood next to her brother for the photograph, he was laughing. Take another picture with your click, 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 click camera. Take another picture with your click, 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 click camera. Sure, I got pictures of my own, of all the people I know.
Hello, this is Dave Laspina. Welcome back to Blind Spot Radio. We're sitting here in our Hudson studio with Mark Haven. He's a photographer that lives in New York and also has a place in upstate in Lexington. Mark Haven is having a show at Davis Orton Gallery, which is open from May 18th to June 24th. We're glad to have him in the studio today to talk about his project, The Commute. Mark, welcome to Blind Spot Radio.
Well, thanks for having me.
And when you started out, were you mostly photographing on the street in New York?
I was trying to teach it was all black and white. I had this little apartment on in Manhattan. I turned the whole apartment into a dark room. It was easier and cheaper just to blacken the windows.
So not just the bathroom. You did the whole thing. The whole thing.
The whole thing. It was, it was a little railroad flat in the East 90s, So it didn't take much. And I bought some books and started to teach myself how to process film. And I got the basics down pretty well. But then I started to meet people in photography. And there was a black and white printer in New York, Sid Kaplan, who's a very, very good printer, Robert Frank's printer. And I used to hang out with him, and he really taught me a lot.
So early on, were you looking at the work of Robert Frank and Cartier-Bresson?
I can't remember the year, but I think it's 64, 65. The Museum of Modern Art had this show, The New Documents, and it was a three-person show. It was Dan Arbus, Gary Winogrand, and Lee Friedlander. And I went to that show, and it just really knocked me out. I mean, I realized that this was a medium that could be very powerful. And I ended up taking I wouldn't call it formal, but the only education I had at the time, I took workshops first with Gary Winogrand and Dan Arbus. The workshop I took with Arbus was her last workshop in 71 before she committed suicide.
Wow. So you're interviewed for part of one of her biographies. I remember reading that.
Years ago, true. Patty Bosworth, who did her biography. Sought out people who had been in that last workshop.
Right. And you've heard recently they've been showing her slideshows that she did in the workshops. You told me that there were two Japanese gentlemen that recorded the
all
workshops.
All of the text accompanied that. Remember, her monograph came out after she died.
Right.
She was really not that well known.
Right.
In fact, she had had a brother who was much more well known than she was, Howard Nemiroff, poet. But it was after she died, the monograph came out. The text in that monograph was provided by there were two Japanese students in the workshop that I took whose English was really not very good, and they asked permission to tape the lectures, the talks, and the text in the monograph came from those tapes.
Oh, I see. And then, Gary Winogrand was hosting workshops at his apartment?
In his apartment on the Upper West Side. which and I was living there at the time. New York was very different in the late 60s and early 70s. Right. So you could find very inexpensive large apartments for very little money. Nobody wanted to live in New York in the 70s.
Right. And at those workshops, I heard at Gary Winogrand's workshops, I heard, maybe not while you were there, but some of the guest artists that would come show their work. William Megelson came once.
He didn't come while I was there. Photography, this was the pre-celebrity photographer.
Right.
So everyone was accessible. You wanted to meet somebody, or I called up Dwayne Michaels once, and I said, so-and-so knows you, and he suggested I give you a call, and do you mind if I come in and watch you print for a week? Well, no problem. You know, I came down, and you can't do that today. So there was something kind of very democratic about the industry that just doesn't exist now.
Everyone was on the same playing field.
And there was no place to show it.
Right.
You didn't. There was no money in it, so there was no point in thinking about making money.
So everyone was just showing work to each
other. Right. The Soho Photo Gallery started. I actually had the first exhibit at the Soho Photo Gallery.
Oh, wow.
It was started by Lee Romero and a bunch of other people. Lee is a New York Times photographer. And it was an effort to make a community where you could bring your work and get some feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was hard and lonely working in isolation.
Right. So RIT is the Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York, and they for decades were strictly a trade school. And in the mid 70s, they started to become one of the first places, along with visual studies workshops, that offered MFA degrees. And so you're talking about they wanted people that hadn't earned their gone through the RIT program for the bachelor's program and
exactly
right. They wanted more diversity.
They needed more a diverse faculty because prior to that, everyone who taught there had graduated from RIT.
Right,
which seems like a ridiculous way to put together a faculty.
Right,
so they I think they saw the wisdom in opening it up.
So you're one of the first artists with a capital A after Minor White.
Minor, that's true. Minor White was teaching at RIT
before
he moved to MIT.
Right. And so you started teaching up there, and you started driving back and forth each week.
Well, yes. The first year I commuted, and I did this because at that time there was this great airline called People's Express, and you could fly back and forth from New York for like $39.
Oh, wow.
In fact, I can remember on two occasions taking a cab from Newark to the city, and the cab was more money than the airline.
Oh, my gosh.
Those days, unfortunately, just didn't last long enough.
Well, the gas crisis must have put an end to that.
Yeah, maybe it was. I guess it was.
Right.
So the first year I commuted.
Right.
And the second year, my wife and son moved up to Rochester. Mm-hmm. We thought I'd give them a kind of suburban experience.
Right.
That didn't work out. They really missed New York for any number of reasons. And so they moved back, and I decided that I would kind of commute back and forth.
Right. And you went on a brief sabbatical, and all during this time you always photographed with a 35mm camera in black and white.
I was a black and white photographer. Yeah. That's what I saw in black and white.
Right.
I didn't really see in color. I mean, I shot color commercially, but I never thought of it as a way for me to express myself. But I had a sabbatical, the idea of coming back to this commuting two-city lifestyle was a little bit depressing. So I looked for a project that would get me involved a little bit more than just the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always been curious about trailer park living.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a friend up there, and we kind of visited several trailer parks, and I found one that seemed to fit my personality and lifestyle.
It looked right.
It looked right. It was Harper Park,
mm-hmm.
and I moved in, both for the personal experience, and also I liked the idea of living in New York City. I live in a big vertical building, Manhattan, and then moving to this very rural horizontal life.
Right.
So visually, I liked that.
And the trailers are about the same size as most New York apartments.
Well, it was. Yeah. I happen to have a larger New York apartment, but yes, they're not big.
Right.
But I moved in for the experience and also to document right. the people and the landscape.
Right. And just this whole notion of living in a metal box in Rochester in the snow seems completely, completely.
Well, it is true. I wondered about that myself, but they're surprisingly quick to heat. You know, you turn up the thermostat in 10 minutes, you're basically living in a tin can.
Right.
And so they get warm quite quickly. There's not a lot of space to warm up.
Right. So you started to meet neighbors, and
I did two things. I first moved in, but mm-hmm. I also wanted a different photographic experience. So I mm-hmm. changed formats. I switched from 35 to a medium format. I started using a Mamiya 6, a square format. And I also decided that I would really see if I could deal with this color issue that I kind of always had been dismissing as a medium for me. And it made the whole idea of moving in and trying to produce work that showed this lifestyle and the landscape more exciting.
Right.
And I took to it quickly. I liked the format, mm-hmm. and I liked the idea of dealing in color. I had never printed color before. Right. I had to teach myself. Right. But, of course, working at RIT, I have a lot of help.
So did you start out photographing just your neighbors or just everything from your first-person perspective?
I wanted people to get used to me.
Right.
You know, I wanted to approach this from an insider's point of view. So I would walk around with my camera over my neck wherever I went. People started, hey, you know, what's that? And
there's the guy with the camera.
There's the guy with the camera, and he lives here.
Right.
So people, it takes a while to get people to trust you, you know?
Right.
And after a few weeks, people would stop me, and I'd ask to make their photograph, or there was something on their lawn that interested me. So after a short period of time, people would invite me to dinner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would start to get to know people,
right.
and mainly the retirees. Now, Harper Park at that time had over 400 trailers. A third of them were renters.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to notice the cultural differences between the people who owned their trailers and the people who rented them.
Right.
And these were kind of fascinating details for me.
Mm-hmm.
The main difference, of course, the trailers looked better.
Right.
But they disguised their hitch.
Right. So each trailer had a hitch cozy or like
something. A bush, some kind of crazy lawn ornament.
Right.
You know, but if you owned it, you want them to hide the fact that it was mobile.
Mobile. Could you edit a whole series of trailer hitches?
I actually have about 12. And you can, just the facades of trailers, and you can tell which ones are renters and which ones are owners.
And so, what fascinated you? Did you look at more at everything through portraits, or was it more the aesthetic details, the culture?
It was both. I mean, I think there's a unique landscape trailer living. I live in Manhattan. People don't have lawn ornaments, so that, of course, you'd notice.
Right.
Some of them were just, you know, outrageously ridiculous.
Right.
But people took pride in displaying if they were lawn ornaments, how they displayed them, where they placed them. The space was interested me, and the colors.
The colors, yeah.
I mean, you know, this was a trailer park in a kind of wooded sort of area, but each space had each living space, while it was small, had a personal look to it.
Personal look, yeah. So people didn't have much interior space to decorate it, so they sort of,
some of them really went to great lengths,
yeah,
to decorate their
right.
Only the owners, the renters, they would never.
It was more transient lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what was Christmas like?
Christmas was Christmas like I had not seen before. There was one woman. It took me at least a year and a half to get her to let me photograph her. But when I walked into her, she finally agreed. And when I walked in, I was just wowed. I mean, she had decorated the entire interior of this trailer in this Christmas motif. Christmas wrapping paper on the walls, this incredible manger which was lit up, a gingerbread kind of house. She did it every year for her kids and now her grandkids. And she was in her early 80s, I think, when I first met her, right. Arlene. But also she became a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I would be in that neighborhood, that area, I would stop by, and she was a great gossip. So I'd have a cup of coffee, and we would gossip about the people in the trailer park.
Or you could catch up even after you didn't live there anymore.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
And so this project, which you ended up calling Harper Park, and you can see it on your website, which is Mark Haven.
MarkHavenPhotography.com, yeah.
That's great. And but it had some artistic success in the artistic editorial world.
Yes, it did. I mean... it was shown quite a bit. I showed it. There was a show in Boston. It was published in initially Double Take magazine, mm-hmm. and then Zoom in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
I did a show with the work in Italy, which was well received. And then people were responding to the work. I had sold them to several museums and collectors. And while Nest Magazine, which was a wonderful publication, unfortunately, like most fine publications, don't last very long.
Right.
I think it lasted for 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
They saw the work, and they responded to it, but they particularly wanted me to do a profile on Arlene, my friend who decorated her trailer.
Mm-hmm.
So for the following year, this is almost 8 years after I had initially photographed mm-hmm. her, she redecorated her trailer, and actually on my website I have that diptych, the two portraits of Arlene.
Oh,
from the first time to I think 2000 when I went back and re-photographed.
And Nest was a really cool magazine that every single issue was different in some major way.
That's right.
It'd be die cut or it'd have
odd cuts. It wasn't necessarily a rectangle.
Right, and it was all about living spaces.
Yeah, they had a very broad interpretation of what constituted a nest.
Right.
And in fact, another project of mine, this was The Doll Lady,
mm-hmm.
They published that work.
So they published some earlier work.
They published earlier work.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
And then, so you took another little bit of time off from commuting to Rochester and moved back to New York, but... The next time you moved up, you started work on the project that's being shown right now.
Right. I tend to work a couple of years on these personal documents. And after I had finished the Harper Park work, I was looking for my next project. And I was driving back to the city and stopped. I had my camera and I stopped and made a photograph. And when I processed it and looked at the contact sheets, I thought, gee, this could be a project. And it actually evolved into a two-year project where I decided to photograph this tedious commute that I was doing. Now, I was flying and driving, but once I decided to really concentrate on the commute, on the actual drive, I started to drive quite often.
Hmm.
So my six-and-a-half-hour trip evolved into an 11-and-a-half, 12-hour trip. But it didn't seem to bother me because I was really being very productive, and I shot a lot, and I just wanted to photograph or document the experience.
Right, and so you would start out driving first thing in dawn, so you could get the most daylight out of the trip.
I wanted to do the seasons.
Right.
You know, I wanted to do the times of day.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to kind of concentrate on the various. Light,
right.
The times of day in terms of light,
right.
And also the seasons, of course.
Right, and then did you mostly go up Route 17?
Yeah, I tend to do when my trip was. I would either go across New Jersey
mm-hmm.
to 81,
mm-hmm.
and then into New York State, and then make a left on Route 17, which is now I think 86.
Oh, it's a highway now. That's right,
a big highway. But then it was still 17.
Right.
Where I would drive up the Palisade Parkway mm-hmm. to Route 6, and onto 17, and then just drive on 17, which became the Southern Tier, and I drive it to Route 390, which would take me up to Rochester.
Rochester.
Yeah, and it's about a 350-mile trip, so it's a long trip.
And what was the first picture that you mentioned that you took that really set you off and say, hey, this could be something interesting?
It was a billboard. Yeah. And it was a billboard that was became an abstraction of a McDonald's sign. There was little suggestions of McDonald's, but it was just the madness of several notices and announcements on the billboard, which had been ripped apart. And it became just the kind of color tableau of the culture.
And then other images that are in the show that I remember, there's a field burning that you drive by, and there's a couple old ladies that look like they could live in Harper Park, a couple old ladies on the side of the road.
That's right.
And but there's this really great picture that's it's kind of furious and sad at the same time. It's a picture you took just your hand on the wheel, and it's blurry and it's dark, and is after a while, is that supposed to be representative of the dull travel?
Well, you do a 350-mile trip. There's a monotony that you can't dismiss. It's a self-portrait.
Right. That's the self-portrait in the picture.
That's right.
Did you listen to books on tape or anything? Or
I would try to, but I found that it was a distraction from seeing.
From shooting, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you know. I was surprised at how much you see along the way if you really stop to look.
Right.
That surprised me. I thought there wouldn't be as much material as I started to discover.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. And so a common theme that we talked about before was that a story like this where you got to meet these great artists when you're young and in your 20s, and then living in the trailer park, you get to meet people and talk to them and see their homes. And so and that's similar way to like Diane Arbus used to work. She gained access through photography and into the things that interest them. So that seems a common theme in your work.
Well, I think a camera it gives you access.
Right.
If you're sincere and serious about what you're doing, people pick up on that, even if they don't understand it.
Right.
And also, I think for some people, certainly me, if I put a camera in front of my eye, my personality is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more assertive.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do things with a camera that I would think two or three times if I didn't have the camera in front of my eye. So it does give you access. And I found that it gives you access everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Gives you an excuse to go photograph. And
it's
to
an
travel,
excuse,
and,
but also to meet people.
To meet people,
it's a terrific, it's a passport in some way.
Right, it's a passport. That's great. And so, and just recently, you've retired from your commute.
I retired from RIT June of last year, and I'm enjoying that. I never expected this, but I ended up being there for 27 years.
Wow.
I mean, with time off often, but nonetheless, it was 27 years, and I was ready. You know, I mean, the not so much the teaching, but giving up academia, and giving up the commute was a real.
Right,
it's delicious.
And so you're saying that now you're teaching some workshops, and one of the workshops you just taught was in Cuba.
Cuba, yeah, in January. I've been going to Cuba quite often the last two or three years. My son and daughter-in-law and grandchildren live there. They're journalists. So I can go in and out pretty at will, really. Visiting family in Cuba, there's not a problem with getting in.
Right.
And so after I met the head of the photography department at one of their universities, ISA, Instituto Superior de Arte.
Right.
And it's a fabulous school. There's a wonderful documentary on it. And, you know, I suggested I might do a workshop. So in January, I did a week workshop with a Cuban class, which was kind of fascinating.
Is it easy to photograph in Cuba, or are people shy? Suspicious?
Well, the problem with Cuba is that there's so many obvious visual stereotypes.
Right. You know,
the old cars, the rundown buildings.
The great colors.
So and great colors. So it's easy to do that because they're so used to tourists coming
right
there. I think without the language skills, it would be difficult to get beyond that right surface impression.
Right.
You need to be able to speak language or have access through
something
through
else.
Somebody else. Yeah.
So how are you going to crack that Cuban egg? How are you going to change it? Well, first and primarily, you're down there to be a grandfather.
Yeah, I'm down there to, you know, I have a certain expectation that I'll be grandpa.
Right. And then also you're talking about potentially, you know, since you have a house up in Lexington, doing some project associated upstate.
Yeah, this is the first year that I can spend some extended time at this house. So I'm hoping to start to photograph this very rural community that we're part of.
Right. Would it be more the homes or more the landscape?
I think the people.
The people, yeah.
Yeah, I don't find the landscapes, it's more predictable to me.
Right.
I kind of know what that's going
to
be.
Right, that's another tough cliche to get past.
I think so.
The bucolic upstate landscape. Right.
Well,
thanks a lot, Mark. We appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thanks
so much. I want to remind everyone that Mark Haven's The Commute is at the brand new wonderful Davis Orton Gallery right here on 114 Warren Street. If you'd like to sign up for their mailing list, you can email info@davisortongallery or give them a call at 518-697-0266. The show is up from May 18th to June 24th. And in the back room, there's another road theme show called From the Road by Remy Thornton. Those are up the same days from May 18th to June 24th.
Start, stop, and start. Stupid acting smart. Flirting with the flicks. You say it's just for kids. You'll be the victim of your own dirty tricks. You got yourself to tease and displease. Swinging wide, you walked into high, looking at your feet, failure's complete.